From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We don't want to be on a glide slope to a situation like Syria and Iraq. That's the reason why we're watching it that closely. That's the reason why we develop options for what we might do in the future.
That was the voice of U.S. Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter Thursday at a press conference at the Pentagon, warning that the group ISIS was establishing training sites in Libya and recruiting foreign militants.
They're welcoming foreign fighters to flock there the way in years past they did in Syria and Iraq. They're trying to take over the reins of the economy and tax it the way you see ISIL doing in Syria. So you see the same kind of ambitions on their part that you see realized in full flower in Syria and Iraq.
Carter said Washington is developing options for what it might do in the future. There were conflicting statements from the State Department about U.S. intentions towards Libya. RT's Guyan Chichikayan has more.
Mixed signals about military action in Libya we're getting from U.S. officials. Last week, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, said the U.S. was preparing to take, quote-unquote, a decisive military action in Libya. Today, his boss, U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter, said the U.S. has not made a decision yet.
We're watching the situation very carefully, and there's a lot going on there right now, but we haven't made any decisions to take.
Secretary Carter
action.
Made this statement around the same time as I was asking the State Department about the prospect of the U.S. bombing Libya again.
I think the very fluid situation in terms of the political climate in Libya, frankly, we believe allows groups like ISIL to have a foothold.
Did the Obama administration see it coming as it helped topple Gaddafi back in 2011?
I don't think ISIL existed back in 2011, not in its present form, but you can argue with that.
To what extent did the proliferation of terrorists in Libya catch the Obama administration by surprise?
Look, I mean, we understood that Libya was a very ungoverned space in the wake of Gaddafi's downfall. We worked very hard.
It wasn't ungoverned when Gaddafi was still in power.
Again, let's be very clear about the situation that you say when we intervened in Libya. And if you need me to walk you through it, I'm happy to do that. But we had the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, threatening to wipe out cities. I think, and again, I'm paraphrasing now, but to hunt people down like animals or dogs and kill them. He threatened to do that to his own population, so we intervened.
Well, in the absence of Gaddafi, now conflicting tribes are killing each other, and ISIL is gaining ground amid the chaos. In November, the U.S. military killed a Daesh leader with an airstrike in Libya. As we understand, what is now being discussed is further military action. The State Department spokesperson did concede that the power vacuum in Libya has contributed to its becoming a new haven for terrorists. But what I did not get a clear answer on was whether the Obama administration had any idea back in 2011, as it helped bomb Gaddafi out of power, that before long, the U.S. could be back to Libya bombing terrorists.
Former U.S. diplomat James Jotra spoke with RT's Andrew Farmer about Washington's latest plans for the North African nation it bombed into chaos less than 5 years ago. Farmer began by asking if another U.S. intervention there would help matters.
No, of course not. If you look at the headlines in the American media about Secretary Carter's press conference, the only thing that was firm and definite is that he wants to increase maternity leave for female personnel in our military, which I'm sure has Daesh terrified. But on the question of Libya and what to do about Libya, there was nothing clear coming out of this. There is no credible government in Libya, even the so-called official government in Tobruk. We don't even know which of these groups we could possibly work with, because all these militias are even more radical than the next one, as is the case in Syria, where we don't have any reliable partners who are essentially not jihad terrorists. So there's, I think one of the reasons there's nothing definite coming out from the secretary is because they don't know what to say and don't know what to do.
Media reports that the Syrian peace talks, set to open Friday in Geneva, could collapse before they even start, hung over the tentative hopes of Syria's people for relief. CCTV's Jack Barton filed this report from Geneva.
The invitations have been sent and preparations are underway at the UN's Geneva headquarters, where the first Syria peace talks in 2 years are scheduled to begin. But Iran continues to accuse Saudi Arabia-backed Sunni opposition groups of being terrorists.
The first criteria was that terrorists with a new mosque should not sit down at a table for political talks with the representatives of the Syrian authorities.
A sentiment shared by opposition groups, Russia once included, who say they will attend anyway.
In any case, we will participate in this conference. We won't let the other delegation from Riyadh, supported by Saudi Arabia, take that space. We are secular Syrians, insisting on the secular identity of Syria.
Some groups want a ceasefire before talks begin. Others want the currently excluded Kurds to attend. And the Syrian government insists it won't make any further concessions while it's recapturing territory. But all sides have tentatively backed the current peace process that aims to produce a political transition leading to elections.
The first aim of the talks will be a ceasefire in all parts of the country except those held by extremist groups like ISIL, so that humanitarian aid can begin reaching large parts of Syria.
If the negotiations do go ahead, the UN intends to separate groups into different rooms and act as a mediator, something known as proximity talks. The UN plans to spread negotiations over 6 months to give enough time for a real compromise to emerge that might end the bloodshed. Jack Barton, CCTV, Geneva.
This past week, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, known as CELAC in the Spanish acronym, met in Quito, Ecuador. We spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, about that and more. Tony, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
Hi, Don. It's good to be talking to you again. As usual, there's a great deal to cover.
Indeed. So let's start.
So, yeah. sorry, Don. And the big event of the week has been the fourth summit of heads of state of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. And something that I found very interesting is that the coverage hasn't been as intense.
Because they're talking about Haiti, that's why.
Well, yeah, and they're talking about Haiti and a whole bunch of other stuff.
That's right, absolutely true.
It just seems to me that, in kind of cultural terms, it seems to me that that's important. That it's important that, in a paradoxical way, that there hasn't been kind of the kind of mega coverage, certainly here in Nicaragua, of the summit that has been applied to previous summits, because that means that these things are becoming routine.
Sure, that's one thing it could mean. Another thing is that there was no space in the U.S. media because everybody was talking about whether Donald Trump was going to a debate or not, and then that he wasn't, that he was having his own.
Well, right, yeah, we've got used to media in the United States not covering these summits of the Community of Latin American States. They tend to give more coverage to the Organization of American States, which right. is a creature of the U.S. government. And so,
and they're and meeting, too, by the way. They're meeting about Haiti, too, by the way.
Right, okay. So, yeah, and it was interesting that I saw a couple of headlines, but several headlines, saying in the same headline that both the OAS and the Community of Latin American States are sending delegations to try and mediate the current crisis in Haiti. So
I'd like to know what the maneuverings are there, because as we've seen in the last couple of years, as first ALBA organized, then ultimately CELAC organized, where you have essentially and UNASUR, the penultimate one, has just about everybody but the United States and Canada,
right,
where they organized as a bloc inside the OAS, they were able to, you know, force votes where suddenly they're voting as a bloc and the United States and Canada and Mexico or Panama are isolated.
Right.
And so I'm wondering how they decided what kind of policy they want to mediate to in Haiti that they're putting in opposition to CELAC.
Yeah, and Haiti's, and you know, you probably know much more about Haiti than I do, because you've been talking to people who, with decades of experience of working and living and discussing the various crises that Haiti has passed through over the last 30 years. But and the impression that that I get here is that there are two different approaches. The approach of the OAS is the neocolonial approach. Let's send a delegation and help these poor Haitians that don't know how to run their country. Let's help them run their country. And that's that is the kind of essence of the approach of the OAS and its bureaucracy and the United States government that backs those kinds of OAS initiatives.
Well, Dr. Gerald Horn would say that that's been the U.S. policy going back to when John Calhoun was forming the U.S. policy, and he, of course, was a slaveholder that was concerned about the slave uprising there in 1804.
Right, exactly. So and that's the kind of ideological historical context from which the OAS would tend to come, you know, or at least the secretariat of the OAS, because right. They're so identified with the policy of the United States, and in fact, is it Almagro, the Uruguayan, who's now the secretary of the OAS? He's had kind of several sharp exchanges with various people in various leaders in Latin America as a result of his subservience to the United States, but in particular Venezuela. But I know over Haiti, the CELAC approach is, well, look, this is a sister country. We can't allow it to collapse into chaos and crisis, and nor can we allow it to continue under the auspices of the imperialist intervention, principally at the hands of France, Canada, and the United States, but facilitated by the United Nations Security Council and the UN bureaucracy in general under Ban Ki-moon. And they're saying, we have to intervene in order to guarantee the sovereignty and stability of the country. And so it'll be interesting to see how those different approaches play out.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you definitely.
That's so, there have been people like Daddy Cherie, for example, here in the Spanish speaking media, Carlos Aznarez, the very well respected radical journalist in Argentina, who's been the victim of accusations by the new Argentinian authorities of being anti-Semitic, and he's been because as a result of his position over Palestine, and he's written about Haiti, and Daddy Cherie has written about Haiti, and they're suggesting that the situation is now so volatile and has deteriorated so much that in effect there exist what they refer to as pre-revolutionary, the conditions for a revolution. Now, who knows? I mean, it's so difficult from the outside to be able to know, but I'm certainly the situation in Haiti has deteriorated so much that the OAS and the CELAC are not sending delegations there for fun. There's something very, very deep and serious
going on.
There's
a fight over it. There's definitely a fight over Haiti's future, and clearly its future is in play, or at least it's perceived that way, and it seems that way on the ground. There was a piece that was at the blackagendareport.com website, this week's Black Agenda Radio, where Kim Ives spoke with
them. Was that Glenn Ford?
Yeah, Glenn Ford interviewing Kim Ives, who's a journalist, of course, that covers
Haiti. Kim, And I don't know Kim Ives, but I really respect his work.
And they were parsing exactly that, you know, is it a pre-revolutionary condition or a pre-coup / occupation? Because there is the occupation right now, of course. They don't term it that, but there's the UN peacekeepers on the ground there who, besides killing a bunch of people with disease because they were dumping sewage into their drinking water and such.
Not just once, but twice in 2012 and last year.
That's right, yeah. And of course, all the other allegations that go with UN peacekeepers, particularly with the way they deal with the local population. whether that's, you know, I consider that an occupation. I'm sure the people of Haiti consider it an occupation, but an actual formal occupation by perhaps the United States, I don't think they'll be able to organize OAS into doing that anymore. And either that or an actual cultural and social and political revolution, like the real thing again.
Yeah, and it's very, very clear that the states in the SELAC structure are very much opposed to the current UN occupation. And I think they are opposed to the current UN occupation. I mean, obviously, the right-wing states are more sympathetic to the current status quo. But
you've even had that stuff in play, like in Brazil. Like, for example, Brazil's armed forces participate in the UN, but you have people in the streets in Brazil that are demanding that they show solidarity with the Haitian people and pull out.
Yeah, that shows the kinds of tensions that exist within the SELAC structure.
Let me just interject one other thing. Another historical point worth noting here. Just as Haiti had the first real, certainly the first anti-slave revolution and perhaps the first democratic revolution in this hemisphere, then again, they elected Jean Bertrand Aristide before Hugo Chavez was elected. He was the first leftist leader that was elected in a very long time, I'd say maybe since Pinochet. So they again were in the forefront. And now, if they end up having a revolution and installing a socialist, you know, people's regime there, they're the example of that for Argentina, Brazil, a lot of places, were, Honduras. You know, that example must scare the hell out of people in Washington.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it just goes to show how hollow and fragile all this nonsense that analysts are coming out about the conservative restoration. And that's in Latin America. And that what the situation in Haiti shows, that the fundamental principles of the government's, like that of Mauricio Macri, for example, or any other of these, you know, the right wing ideologues that have taken over the Venezuela's National Assembly on behalf of the United States government, and all these people, they have nothing to offer, and ordinary people at grassroots in Latin America and the Caribbean, and the situation in Haiti is perhaps the most extreme demonstration of that.
Well, OAS maybe is also maybe a caricature, but perhaps an illustration in any event of exactly what the conditions are in the region, because you have the vast majority of the membership swinging one way and the secretariat perhaps a puppet of the United States still, but with no legs.
Yeah, and you've got very strident calls by solidly placed heads of government in South America. I'm talking about Rafael Correa in particular, but not just
the host
him.
Of SELAC, by the way.
And yeah, and he's saying is that the OAS is finished and it needs to be replaced by the community of Latin American and Caribbean states.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, so Quito, the Ecuadorian government at the summit in Quito through 2015, Ecuador had the pro tempore presidency, the temporary presidency of the community of Latin American and Caribbean states. And this fourth summit of heads of state of SELAC in Quito over the last few days, they handed that on to the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's, you know, and that whole mechanism is just, it's just so much more democratic, isn't it? And if you can contrast that with the OAS, what the OAS has got is the same kind of bureaucratic structure that has debilitated the United Nations for decades, whereby they have a permanent secretariat that is susceptible to being utterly co-opted by the United States government and the allies of the United States government.
Right, a bureaucracy with its own interests, which of course can be bought.
Yeah. So then, but with SELAC, what you've got is a rotating presidency that may have some element of permanent administrative bureaucracy for certain purposes, but it rotates year by year so that it's actually every year there's a troika. A group of three countries made up of the current temporary president, the country, which for the moment is Dominican Republic, the country that preceded the temporary president for the current period, in this case Ecuador, and the country that is likely to assume, or the country that's scheduled or programmed to assume the presidency in 2017.
Right.
And that is what provides continuity between previous periods and periods to come, because that structure does that.
Right.
But it also makes the policy structure and the policy implementation structure of CELAC independent,
right,
of some bureaucracy liable to be co-opted by undesirable elements like the United States government.
Yeah, right. It's amazing. Almost every time, no matter who I'm speaking with anywhere in the world, and we speak with people all over the world every day here, and just about everyone, I'm embarrassed about my government in front of them. Actually, you know, embarrassed with, and I could go on and do for hours about why.
Well, I think it's perfectly logical that people in the United States should feel embarrassed about their government, and that's the case of people in many countries, including most governments in the European Union.
Mm.
But one of the things that people in the United States should be absolutely proud of and absolutely fundamentally, you know, honored by in yourselves is the incredible record of people at grassroots in terms of their solidarity with nations that have been victims of their government.
Yeah.
And the United States people has a record of solidarity that is probably only matched by the people of Cuba. You know, I know, I'm serious about that. I know. Over the next month or so, we'll be hosting three or four delegations for medical delegations and dental medical delegations. People at grassroots from the United States who fundamentally believe in solidarity with peoples, maybe not in a radical political sense, but in a deep, profound humanitarian sense. And that's something that everybody in the United States should be very proud of, in sharp contrast to the disgraceful behavior of their government.
Well, you know, I guess it's not their fault that they don't teach civics in school anymore, because unfortunately that tendency, which, you know, I don't know if I'd say it prevails among the people here, but it certainly you can see it manifest in many people here. Unfortunately, that gets manipulated, and you end up with R2P and you know, all these humanitarian quote unquote interventions.
Right. Well, you know, and that's part of the contradictory nature of how nations and peoples develop, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yep.
So then, should we go back and have a look at what the CELAC declaration actually came out?
Oh yeah, let's look at this year's CELAC. We should definitely cover this.
So it's in many ways it's a repeat of stuff from the previous declaration. You know, an end to the United States blockade of Cuba, a defense of the recovery by Argentina of the Malvinas Islands. And things to do with, they don't actually mention directly the situation between Bolivia and Chile, where Bolivia's demanding that Chile assign to Bolivia a sovereign access to the Pacific Ocean, that Chile actually conquered that bit of land that makes Bolivia landlocked. But they did raise the issue of states that don't have a coastline, in particularly in relation to Paraguay. They focus on the migration issue, and which is a very big deal, in particular here in Central America. And we've had this case over the last month or so of the stranded Cubans trying to make their way from South America up to the United States, whether they're the beneficiaries of this bizarre law of the United States whereby no citizens but Cubans, it applies only to Cuban citizens. If they set foot in the United States territory, they automatically get asylum.
Right.
Now, and that doesn't apply to any other South American or Caribbean citizen.
Is that on the agenda between Cuba and the United States, by the way?
I'm sure it is. Although, as far as I've been following the negotiations between Cuba and the U.S., I haven't seen anything explicitly about it.
I mean, it obviously was intended to encourage people to leave Cuba and come to the United States.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the huge contradiction that the United States is saying, oh, we've got to control immigration from South America and Central America and the Caribbean. And then they have this completely contradictory law, very clearly designed to destabilize Cuban society.
Maybe what they'll do is they'll build that wall, or if Trump builds it, the wall of casinos, and they'll give a card key to Cubans as they leave.
Yeah, absolutely. Or have a little door, Cubans only.
Yeah, it's more
so anyway, style, and that's, you know, one can sort of satirize that a lot, but it's actually a very, very serious issue for hundreds of thousands of people.
Yep.
So then they're also looking at the issue of sovereign debt in particular, and that's very much a result of the initiative taken by President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner of the Argentinian president last year in relation to Argentina's negotiations, or in Cristina's case, her refusal to negotiate with the Wall Street vulture funds, who are trying to strip Argentinian taxpayers of something over $1.5 billion. It's interesting that CELAC has maintained that in its agenda, despite the fact that Mauricio Macri, a right-wing buddy of the Wall Street vultures, is now the president of Argentina. He actually didn't attend the summit, and on the pretext that because Quito is at a height of over, I think it's 2,400 meters above sea level, his doctors apparently said to him, well, you can't go to Quito because it's too high.
What? Does he go to Denver?
No idea. He might go to Aspen, mightn't he? So there. Anyway, that's just a little detail. And he sent his vice president, who's very much identified with the policies of the U.S. State Department, a woman called Michetti. Anyway, and so that it's interesting that CELAC, despite the change of government in Argentina, is still very much promoting some mechanism to deal with restructuring of sovereign debt.
Yeah, I mean, even the Argentinian people feel very strongly about that, perhaps stronger than anyone on the planet, since they're the ones that'll get stuck with the bill.
Well, sure, and it's such an issue for everybody in these vulnerable countries that have been essentially pillaged by international financial institutions.
Well, here too, I mean, look at Flint. That's the reason that they used as a justification for feeding those people poisoned water.
Right.
Detroit. Look at all these places.
Yeah. So it's not just an issue for sovereign states. It's actually an issue for people at grassroots everywhere.
Yep.
And certainly in Ireland, for example, in my country, people are up in arms about the water charges. I mean, the Irish government, in the wake of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, the Irish government not only took on the payment of debt to irresponsible lenders, mostly in Germany, the UK, France and the United States. But as a result, they engaged in these privatization policies, and one of them was to privatize water.
Yep.
And there's huge resistance to that in Ireland.
You know, well, anyway. everywhere that public institutions exist, or even where public gatherings have the authority to borrow, they're indebted like crazy to some small group of people, I don't know, on Wall Street, London, wherever the hell they are, wherever that money ends up.
Right.
And it's a load on the entire planet, like in every public institution in the West.
Right. Yeah, and that's exactly what the progressive governments in Latin America, and to some extent too the right-wing governments, you know, who are kind of looking at events in Haiti, and you know, and they understand that they've got to strike a balance between the ridiculous right-wing neoliberal policies that they kind of con people into voting for, and the reality that they have to maintain a balance within.
Appreciate your time, as always, a pleasure.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. I hope all goes well for the rest of the day and for the weekend. Look forward to talking to you next week.
Same. Thanks a lot. Take care. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.